This is an ABC podcast.
Tala for Lover, and welcome to Pacific Beat. I'm Talia Olatia. If you're in the Solomon Islands or Vanuatu, then I hope you are able to stay safe and dry after Cyclone Harold really forced everyone to bunker down over the weekend. In a display proving that the cyclone season doesn't stop for a global pandemic, Cyclone Harold has intensified to a Category 5 system, with winds at its centre reaching 215 kilometres per hour. Coming up very shortly, you'll hear the latest on Cyclone Harold, where it's been, where it's heading, and what damage it's caused along the way. Also today on the program, you'll get the latest update on COVID-19 from around the region. There have been 17 more positive cases for COVID-19 in Guam. To date, the country now has 112 confirmed cases, with 23 recoveries and 4 deaths. Despite running low on PPEs, personal protective equipment, you'll hear how the Guam people are rallying together and making their own.
A number of us have access to 3D printers, sewing machines, and just experience crafting things. And so we kind of mobilized, developed some prototypes, and we've tested them out in our local hospitals. And the doctors and nurses seem to actually really like them. And so we've started producing them.
Also on Pacific Beat, you'll hear from residents from the Fijian city of Lautoka, the second largest in Fiji, whose two-week lockdown that was supposed to end last Friday has been extended till tomorrow. Residents say it's tough, but worth it.
It's worth it, because the last 14 days now, only one case until Tuesday, so that should mean that Lautoka, people in Lautoka are okay.
Also, the Australian Human Rights Law Centre is among those concerned about the legacy left behind in Bougainville by Australian mining company Rio Tinto. For 6 months, they've interviewed Bougainvillean people about the impacts and put together a human rights report, complete with recommendations for the company Rio Tinto, as well as the governments of Bougainville, Papua New Guinea and Australia.
I was anticipating that there would be, for example, pollution from the mine into the local rivers, but what I hadn't been prepared for, I think, was the extent to which there are new ongoing harms that are being caused all the time as a result of the waste that's been left there.
Those stories and more coming up with me, Talia Olatia, here on Pacific Beat.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
People across Vanuatu are bunkered down this morning as Cyclone Harold intensified into a Category 5 storm overnight, with winds up to 215 kilometres an hour expected at its centre. It's currently tracking southeast and is expected to pass slowly through the country's central islands, places like Santo, Malekula, Ambrim and Pentecost. The storm's already caused major flooding in Vanuatu over the weekend, and in neighbouring Solomon Islands, as many as 27 people are feared dead after they were washed off a packed ferry that had been taking them to their home villages as a part of that government's efforts to prepare for COVID-19 by moving thousands of people from the capital, Honiara. Authorities confirmed last night they've recovered 5 bodies so far. For more on Cyclone Harold, I'm joined by Neville Coop, the director of Nandraki Weather. Good morning, Neville.
Good morning, Talia.
What is the latest on Cyclone Harold, Neville?
Look, it's been a very devastating 24 hours for people in northern and central Vanuatu, and that this very destructive cyclone, Category 5, continues to wreak havoc and will do so through the rest of today. It's been slow moving during the latter part of yesterday and overnight, just to the west of Luganville on the island of Espiritu Santo. That's the largest island of Vanuatu Archipelago, and also the second largest population centre. It is now, having completed a small loop, travelling very slowly overnight and intensifying, it's now starting to move southeast through the islands, and it will continue to wreak havoc today. It is a very powerful cyclone, as you mentioned. It's Category 5 winds. Sustained winds over 200 kilometres an hour, gusting up to 300 kilometres per hour. So we're talking here massive devastation from the winds. But in addition to that, it's they've had heavy rain now for over 24 hours, and the flooding will be particularly devastating. landslips, sea flooding from storm surges. I can only begin to imagine what we're going to see once the cyclone moves away. It's notoriously difficult to get information from that part of the world at the best of times, but throw in, of course, the issue of the COVID pandemic and the government's attempts to try and prevent that from spreading. We are going to see, I fear, quite a massive human disaster over the next 24 hours as things clear to the east later today and tonight. So it's you might remember several weeks ago, back in March, I had noted that the season wasn't over and that there was a expected monsoon surge coming in the first few weeks of April, and I had hoped and prayed that people were planning for this as part of their COVID response. I'm not quite sure yet how far they'd gotten in such planning, or if any at all, and we're about to find out, I think, sadly, over the next 24 hours as the true damage of this cyclone becomes more clear.
Because Cyclone Harold has intensified into a Category 5 storm. Any expectation of how long it will stay at that Category 5, or will it start to reduce down?
So the intensification took place at a time when the cyclone was quite slow moving. As I said, it's been just wobbling around to the west of Santo Island overnight, and is now starting to move quickly away to the east. So it's quite interesting, because this is exactly what the computer models had predicted going way back to this time last week, that it would slow down as it approached Vanuatu. So now that it's moving more rapidly, it will probably start to weaken slightly, but it's still going to be quite a powerful Category 4 system when it passes to the south of Viti Levu, the main island of Fiji, probably later Wednesday, and it will pack quite a punch for those in Fiji. Unlikely to make a direct landfall, but staying close enough that they experience damaging storm force winds and heavy rain. And then following that, it will pass pretty close to Nuku'alofa and the island of Tongatapu and Alea, the southern islands of Tonga, probably on Thursday. So there's still more to come this week from this cyclone, but the worst impacts are likely to be here in Vanuatu from the last 24 hours through to tonight.
And obviously very concerning, as you were saying, that it's tracking towards Fiji. I know that Lautoka and Suva are currently on lockdown for COVID-19 preventative measures. I know that you're currently in Australia, Neville, but your family is in Fiji. Any concerns that they're expressing with, you know, the cyclone heading their way but still having to be in lockdown?
Yes, I am a little concerned for the well-being of my wife and her family. It will pass close enough to Dunandi, which is where she is at the moment with her family, and that it will be quite an unpleasant couple of days ahead. Probably not going to be as completely destructive as it is over. Vanuatu right now, but I have anecdotally heard that the current lockdown regulations are preventing people from moving from their homes, which means they can't really prepare well. I've had contact from people regarding access to their boats. People have commercial boats on Denarau Island. The main tourism area is completely closed at the moment. You cannot get access unless you are living on the island. And yesterday afternoon, I was speaking to the chief pilot from Fiji Airways. Fiji Airways, all of their fleet are currently in Nandi, and they're concerned about the potential impacts of the cyclone on their aircraft. All of their aircraft are on the ground. There's none flying at the moment, so they're considering evacuating those aircraft if necessary. However, many of their flight crew are under 14-day quarantine, and it would take, they need to get permission to release the crew to fly those planes out if needs be. So a lot of logistical issues need to be worked through here that normally aren't there for such events like this, but this is similar, I guess, to Cyclone Sarai early in the season, but much, much stronger. So we do expect there will be some significant impacts to parts of Fiji. So this could not have come at a worse time, really, for people in this part of the world.
It's very true. Neville, thank you so much for the update and for joining Pacific Beat this morning. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome, and please feel free to call back later in the day if you'd like some more information. I'm happy to oblige.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And for people at home, you can always visit the Nandraki Weather Facebook page for more information throughout the day as well. Nandraki is spelt N-A-D-R-A-K-I. That was Neville Coop. He is the director of Nandraki Weather. For more of the impacts that are being felt by Cyclone Harold across the Pacific, as we mentioned, the coronavirus measures and impacts that have taken place as well. I'm joined by Catherine Grau. You're a familiar voice here on Pacific Beat. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Talia.
This really is just evidence that the world keeps turning and cyclones won't stop for this global coronavirus pandemic, isn't it?
That's right, absolutely. As we heard from Neville, this is now a Category 5 cyclone moving very slowly southeasterly through Vanuatu. But already over the weekend, when it was a lower Category 3 and then 4 yesterday on Sunday, it was already causing heavy rain, which caused flooding in the kind of northern and central islands of Vanuatu, which of course has more than 80 islands in the country. Now, because of the coronavirus pandemic, we have seen Vanuatu's government introduce a state of emergency, even though they don't have any cases of COVID-19. And that has really restricted people's movement. There have been bans on social gatherings of more than five. People need to keep their distance from each other, as we do right around the world. So that saw some people rather confused about the measures. And it forced the NDMO director in Vanuatu, Abraham Nussak, to take to social media to try and clear it up. Here he is.
Rule blow, social gathering blow 5 have been applied.
So you can hear here he's saying that the rule about social gatherings of that shouldn't be more than five people are not applying right now because people need to have been moving to safe shelters and evacuation centres over the weekend to make sure they were protected from the cyclone. He said he was coming out to talk because there had been that confusion about the social distancing rules as well, but he said at the moment, of course, people's safety is paramount. Now, they are lucky that there aren't any confirmed cases yet of COVID-19, so you would imagine there is a very low threat there of it spreading in evacuation centres. However, there has been some concern that everyone's focus on COVID-19 in Vanuatu in the last few days and weeks has meant that a lot of people weren't as prepared as they might have been or as they should have been. Here is Augustine Garay, who's from the NGO the Red Cross in Vanuatu, talking about that.
Our focus was more on COVID-19. And now we have moved our focus to the preparedness for the cyclone. And we understand that some people in some communities, maybe they are not really well prepared. We understand that. And we understand that this is one of the most powerful, if it happens, this will be one of the most powerful cyclones that will be affecting some of the provinces that they never experienced this. As during the DCPAM, there are like several provinces, they have experienced this already. But for other provinces, it's more like a new scenario for them.
Now, you did just say NDMO Director Abraham Nussak was advising people to get to evacuation centres, but have they been actually able to get to shelters overnight?
Look, we understand. I mean, they were being warned right across the weekend to make sure that they were heading to places that were safe, places like churches, a hotel in the town of Luganville, which is on Santo Island, which, as we heard, is the second largest town in Vanuatu. I've even seen photos of people choosing to hide in a cave up in Torres Island. That's in the very far north of Vanuatu and extremely remote. Now, as I mentioned, the town of Luganville, it actually has a population of around 16,000 people. The mayor Peter Paddy had been urging people over the weekend to head to the two evacuation centres they had opened. We spoke with him yesterday and he was saying that he was expecting that hundreds would come there last night.
That's one of my big worries because, you know, some of us just live in a small, like small, not a good building, concrete or just a squatter or, you know, they live in squatter areas. And that's why I was like the authority who looks after the town. So the people is my number one priority. So that's why before it gets to category five, I want all these people who think that they're not safe in their own house. So I have to provide them the evacuation center so they can go and stay there so we can look after them throughout the cyclone season.
Now, we have tried to make a few calls to check in on people this morning, but most phones have not been ringing. We expect that is, of course, because of the cyclone. So it's too early at this stage to say the extent of the damage. And as we say and heard from Neville Coop, it really is expected to be in Vanuatu, the Vanuatu area, for the rest of today into early tomorrow morning. And also for Australians in Vanuatu, they've also been warned by the Australian High Commission, urging people to make sure they follow the local warnings, stay inside, and obviously stay as safe as they can.
I mentioned earlier the tragedy in the Solomon Islands with those 27 people missing from that overpacked ferry. What's the latest there, Catherine?
Well, officials, police in Solomon Islands confirmed late yesterday that they have so far found five bodies, three women and two men. But as you say, there were 27 in total who had been missing. They'd been some 738 people who were on board this ferry. That included passengers and crew, so a very packed ferry. They'd taken to the seas, which were extremely rough because of Cyclone Harold. That was late last week. And the 27 who've been missing, feared dead, are believed to have washed off of the ship in those rough seas early on Friday morning. Now, this ferry, of course, had been taking people back to their home villages. It was part of the Solomon Islands government repatriation efforts, trying to get less people in the capital, Honiara, amid this these fears around coronavirus. Of course, they have no confirmed cases yet of COVID-19 in Solomon Islands. But still, people have been trying to make their way to their home villages. At this stage, of course, 22 people are still missing. Police say that they are still trying to recover them and forensic teams are on their way to help with the identification of the bodies when they find them. Of course, there will be in coming days questions about why this particular ferry did set sail, given the weather conditions. Of course, there is that sense of urgency in Solomon Islands about the coronavirus fears. So many people obviously just wanting to get home. We do expect there will likely be an investigation and we'll continue to ask the questions and bring updates here on Pacific Beat. Talia.
Absolutely. Catherine, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks.
That was Catherine Grau there with the latest update on COVID-19 and Cyclone Harold from around the region.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, we were just talking about COVID-19, so here is another update about COVID-19 specifically. The small US territory of Guam has had its largest jump in the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases, with 17 positive results yesterday. But authorities are counting another two as well, that they say tested negative but have been clinically diagnosed as COVID-19 because of the patient's symptoms, and they both had links to previous cases. That means there have now been 112 confirmed cases in Guam of the 192 across the Pacific region, not including Hawaii, Australia or New Zealand. Fiji also had a jump in its numbers over the weekend with five new cases there. Two of them had family ties to other cases already confirmed, while one was a man who recently travelled from India and then went to the town of Lambasa on the island of Vanua Levu. Because he travelled, authorities are now trying to track down everyone he had contact with. Here's Fiji's health minister, Dr. Ifere Me Wanga Inarbeta.
We also realise that because of his travels, there may be others that he may be a part of. And that's all in the antennas of our contact tracing team as they begin to fan out and identify individuals that could have been in close contact with him.
But they've also been forced to lock down part of that town, Lambusa, the first time they've done so outside of Fiji's main island, Viti Levu. We'll have more on the lockdowns in just a moment. Meanwhile, media in the Asian country of Laos are reporting that a 55-year-old Papua New Guinean man has tested positive for COVID-19. He is a mine worker and has travelled through Singapore and Thailand last month. And over the weekend, the Australian government confirmed that Pacific workers who are currently here as seasonal workers will be able to stay in the country for up to 12 months. The Pacific Minister, Alex Hawke, had alluded to an announcement when he spoke with Pacific Beat on Friday, and now he's confirmed their visas can be extended. The government's also announced that workers will have health insurance and be cared for if they do get sick with COVID-19.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
But talking about lockdowns, people in the town of Lautoka in Fiji says a lengthy lockdown of the town prompted by the country's first case of coronavirus has been tough but worth it to try and stop the spread of the virus. The lockdown was initially supposed to be for 2 weeks and was due to come to an end last Friday, but was extended until tomorrow. Locals say it's been particularly tough on women, with many losing their jobs because they worked in the tourism industry. Liam Fox reports.
The lockdown in Lautoka began with locals in a state of panic.
They were rushing everywhere. They were going to the supermarkets. They were filling up their trolleys. They were running to school, getting their children out. Even some of the parents who come all the way from the island, but they live in Lautoka, as soon as they got their children out, they went straight to the wharf, to the boat. They ran. They went straight to the island.
Losana Deranalangi lives there and is a convener with the women's radio station FemTalk. Despite the initial panic back on the 19th of March, when Fiji's first case of coronavirus was identified in Lautoka and the lockdown was put in place, she says things soon calmed down.
During the lockdown, there was no people walking around. There was no public services of buses, transportation, no taxis, and people were adhering to the advice because they were so scared of this disease which has been killing people with no cure.
People were not allowed in or out of Lautoka. Only banks, supermarkets and pharmacies were allowed to remain open. All other businesses and schools were ordered to shut their doors. Supermarkets remained well stocked, but Miss Deranalangi says prices for fresh fruit and vegetables shot up.
Five lemons selling for $5, which used to be only $2, and a bunch, just a bundle of local spinach, which used to be $1, it's selling for $5.
As others have noted, Miss Deranalangi says women felt the impact of the lockdown the hardest.
Because here, most women are breadwinners of the family. And most of them, they work in tourism industries, in the hotels, in Nandi and Lautoka. They've been laid off from work. There's no one going back to work.
Alan Lockington is another Lautoka local.
We visited a few people who were locked down because they haven't gone to work and they're running out of cash and food. And you can see the frustration in their faces.
Mr. Lockington says the shutdown of public transport services made it hard for people who lived out of town.
People running out of food, people who need medication, but because they're too poor to come in a taxi, they can't come into town.
Despite the difficulties, he says the lockdown is a necessary move to stop the spread of coronavirus.
I'm happy. And then we had anticipated it being extended. And it has been extended, and many of my close friends have also agreed.
Ms. Deranalangi agrees.
It's worth it. It's worth it. Because the last 14 days now, only one case until Tuesday. So that should mean that Lautoka, people in Lautoka are okay.
Since Lautoka was locked down, other cases of coronavirus have sprung up around the country. The capital, Suva, was placed in a lockdown of its own late last week, after a husband and wife in one of the city's settlements, who both work as hairdressers, tested positive. Ms. Deranalangi says people in Lautoka are praying the end of their own lockdown means the town has seen the end of COVID-19.
We hope and we pray that this corona will just go out quickly, and we've been having this prayer on and on and on and off so that we get rid of it.
That was La Toka local Losana Derelangi ending that report from Liam Fox.
Practicing good hygiene in public places is very important to slow the spread of coronavirus. When you are outside your home, stay 1.5 meters away from other people. Avoid spitting in public, including after chewing betel nut. Smoking cigarettes is always dangerous, but sharing cigarettes with others can spread the virus, so don't do it. Don't share cups, carver bowls, bottles, or anything else that touches your mouth. Practicing hygiene in public places will help slow the spread of coronavirus.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. Let's squeeze in a little song before we get to News Wrap, brought to us by Marla Damati. And it was also sad news on the weekend that Bill Withers, legendary soul singer who wrote Lean On Me, died at the age of 81. So a little bit of a tribute to Bill Withers. This is Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, I wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away, and I know, I know, I know, I know. Sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. Anytime she goes away.
It definitely feels like the world lost a bit of its sunshine when Bill Withers died on the weekend, but obviously his songs are a great reminder of his musical legacy. That was, of course, Bill Withers there with Ain't No Sunshine. Time now to find out some of the stories making news in the region and around the world. And to do that, I'm joined by Marla Damati. Good morning, Marla.
Good morning.
Now, this is an anniversary, a celebration, which is obviously a good time to be celebrating, to find moments of celebration, because the Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change have celebrated their 1 year anniversary. What a milestone.
I know, and it feels like they've accomplished a lot in that 1 year. Look, youth advocacy group Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change, or PISFCC, have celebrated its 1 year anniversary and reflected on their significant achievements over this short period of time. Now, during this reflection period, the group has also considered their work ahead of them in 2020, including climate change campaigning in the Pacific in an age of coronavirus and physical distancing, which will change the way they operate. PISFCC began last year when 27 USP law students from 8 Pacific Island countries decided to join together to begin a campaign to persuade the leaders of the Pacific Islands Forum to take the issue of climate change and human rights to the International Court of Justice. Now, the PISFCC is a very active organization that has participated in an international scale, such as COP25. So, you know, they are a very big group, and I feel like 2020 will see a lot more of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's always hard for, you know, new businesses, new startups to just get to their first year. It kind of is an indication of whether they can continue to keep going. And it definitely sounds like this youth climate fighting group will be around for quite a while. Talking about someone who's been around for quite a while and then cringing at the segue I just made about the Queen. Oh my goodness. Because just moments ago, the Queen has made a rare televised speech on COVID-19. We're used to her normal Christmas messages that she does once a year, but she's made a special one for COVID-19. What did she have to say?
Well, that's right. The message was recorded at Windsor Castle, and she says, it's been an increasingly challenging time for the nation, bringing grief, financial hardships and enormous challenges. And we heard at the news is that it was filmed with one cameraman who was wearing full protective gear.
Yep.
Let's take a quick listen to what she said.
I'm speaking to you at what I know is an increasingly challenging time, a time of disruption in the life of our country, a disruption that has brought grief to some, financial difficulties to many, and enormous changes to the daily lives of us all. I want to thank everyone on the NHS frontline, as well as care workers and those carrying out essential roles, who selflessly continue their day-to-day duties outside the home in support of us all. I also want to thank those of you who are staying at home, thereby helping to protect the vulnerable and sparing many families the pain already felt by those who have lost loved ones. Together we are tackling this disease, and I want to reassure you that if we remain united and resolute, then we will overcome it.
Now, the Queen's televised address to the nation, it happened just moments ago in response to the coronavirus, is actually only the fifth time the monarch has given such a speech in her 68-year reign. So, you know, five speeches in a 68-year reign, which means probably COVID-19 is a massive situation, not only across the Pacific and Australia, but also Europe, UK, England,
all over the world,
US, everywhere.
Yeah. It's funny, like, I've got some very weird Queen royalty memory, but in 1992, when she had delivered her Christmas message, she referred to the year as being an annus horribilis, which means it's a horrible year. And 1992 was kind of when, like, all her children got divorced, and obviously everything that was going on with the Queen. Also, like, one of her properties, there was a fire. And so in her 1992 speech, she called 1992 a horrible year. And I just wonder what she will say at the end of 2020.
She might bring it back at her Christmas speech of 2020.
She'll just be like, just put it in the bin, guys. Look, we got to Christmas. Just celebrate. You don't even need to listen to a message. Just drink a bottle of rum.
Maybe she'll say, get on the beers.
Exactly. Just congratulate yourselves for making it through the year. It definitely feels like that should be the Queen's message this Christmas 2020. Finally, Marla, you've been bringing us animal news as a little bit of light news to everything that's going on in the world. And some more animals have been able to meet behind the glass thanks to zoo closures.
That's right. I'd like to see myself as the ABC. He's David Attenborough, but, you know, we'll put that on the side. Look, Texas State Aquarium has currently closed its doors to the public due to social distancing requirements, but that hasn't stopped animals inside from hanging out with new friends. Texas State Aquarium staff have apparently been giving some animals a chance to explore parts of the aquarium, as we've seen other aquariums do. A celebrity sloth named Chico got to meet some new dolphin buddies. The dolphins appeared to love Chico, the three-year-old sloth. He took a break from his usual enclosure and, you know, was able to see many of the other aquaria and fishes in the aquarium, which was quite beautiful.
See, what I want, you were saying that you're like the David Attenborough in terms of, you know, narrating these wildlife interactions, but I want like animals and Tinder. Like, this would be prime time for all these animals to just be mating and breeding, because like, we don't have to worry about humans getting away and interrupting their, you know, sexy times.
Are you thinking crossbreeding?
I'm just saying the options are limitless, and I do not want to, like, say some species cannot get it on if they've found love behind the closed doors. Obviously, this will not happen. This is also why they will not let me work in zoos. Let the animals be free. Let them mate who they want to mate. Maybe that won't work. Okay, fair play. Cool.
I'm going to leave that with you. You can mull that over.
You just reflect on that. Think about what you've just said. Marla, thank you so much for bringing us those stories.
My pleasure.
That was Marla Damati there with just some of the stories making news today. Would you like to see the animals at zoos just get it on and just, you know, breeding and mating? Send me a message. I can't be the only one. Seriously, help me out.
In times of health emergencies, it's important to have accurate information. Always check the source of information you read, and don't share information on social media or WhatsApp unless you are sure it's from a trusted source. To find accurate, up-to-date information about the coronavirus, search for ABC Radio Australia, the World Health Organization, or your country's government, online or on Facebook. Being well informed will help protect you and your community from the coronavirus.
You're listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia. The Panguna mine has a bloody history in Bougainville. In the 70s and 80s, it was one of the world's largest copper and gold mines, and it was run by Bougainville Copper Limited, a subsidiary of the Australian mining company Rio Tinto. And while the mine made millions of dollars in profit, anger about the money that locals were getting partly fueled the decade-long civil war that erupted in the late 1980s. The violence forced the mine to close and it's never reopened. But in the years after, pollution from mine tailings flowed into the environment, polluting local rivers. 4 years ago, Rio Tinto walked away from the mine once and for all by transferring its BCL shares to the PNG and Bougainville governments. But critics say it also walked away without helping clean up or rehabilitate the land. The Australian Human Rights Law Centre is among those concerned. They've released a report called After the Mine, Living with Rio Tinto's Deadly Legacy. Karen Adams is the legal director at the Human Rights Law Centre here in Melbourne, and I spoke to her about the report.
We undertook the report because we were contacted by some Australian academics who'd been working with the Catholic Diocese of Bougainville and communities locally in Panguna to try and document some of the impacts of the mine. And as a result of what we heard, we decided that we needed to go out there ourselves and see what had happened, because Bougainville is one of those places that people rarely visit, and the mine is in a particularly remote area. So we went out there, and over the course of 6 months, working with some local researchers, we visited around 38 different villages, and we spoke to many people in different areas who are living downstream of the mine. You know, these are mostly communities living all along the Jabba-Kabarong River system that goes down from the mine, right near the mine pit, down towards the coast.
Did you have any expectation before undertaking this six-month project about what people would say to you and what you were hoping to achieve?
We did have expectations, and I have to say, when I got on the ground, the situation was much worse than I had expected. I was anticipating that there would be, for example, pollution from the mine into the local rivers. You only have to jump on Google Earth to be able to see from satellite images of the area how destroyed it is and the extent of the damage. But what I hadn't been prepared for, I think, was the extent to which there are new ongoing harms that are being caused all the time as a result of the waste that's been left there. And that's because the mine waste is gradually, you know, there was 1 billion tonnes of mine waste discharged from the mine, and that kind of largely got left in the Jabba-Kabarong River Valley area. And as it erodes down into the rivers, it flows down towards the coast, and that means that new areas are constantly getting impacted, because as these huge quantities of mine waste sand fills up the rivers, they flood out into new areas. So we visited areas which had been destroyed by flooding as recently as January last year, and communities living in the lowland, flatland areas downstream from the mine are now bearing the worst of the brunt.
You're talking, you know, about the harms that were caused by the mine, but where does it go from harm into human rights violations?
Well, I mean, I think that the mine waste is impacting on just about every aspect of people's lives living downstream. So keep in mind there are about 12 to 14,000 people who live in villages dotted down the river system from the mine. Now, their basic fundamental rights to clean water, to health and adequate standard of living, their rights to practice their culture, children's rights, women's rights, all of these things are being impacted as a result of the flooding from the mine. So people's water sources are being contaminated as a result of both pollution and from the flooding from the mine. People's health is clearly impacted. People reported to us severe health problems ranging from skin diseases, which we saw ourselves, there are sores, all over people's kind of legs and feet. People reported severe respiratory problems, particularly among children, as a result of both the dust that comes off the tailings mounds and also from children bathing and swimming in the rivers. Women reported severe pregnancy complications as a result of a lot of them have resorted to panning for gold in the rivers as a way of making a living. So they're immersed in this water for hours on end every day. So there's a whole range of different ways in which people's rights are affected and violated by what's been left there. And Rio Tinto has very clear responsibility to do something about that under its obligations under the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights.
And in 2016, Rio Tinto abandoned the mine and in doing so kind of walked away without helping clean or rehabilitate the land that they used. So if they are required to do something, why haven't they? It's, you know, been 4 years already.
Well, I think that they haven't because they think that they can get away with it. I mean, they divested from the mine. They were condemned resoundingly on Bougainville by the autonomous Bougainville government and the people of Bougainville. But, you know, unless someone actually reports these stories and holds them to account for what happened, the reality is that Bougainville, it's out of sight and out of mind for a lot of people, and they've just been able to get away with it. So we're hoping that by shining a spotlight on this through this report, that we can start to interest the people who may have influence with Rio Tinto, including their shareholders in London and Australia.
So what recommendations have you made in the report?
Yeah, so maybe to start with what we're calling for the companies to do, both Rio Tinto and its former subsidiary, Bougainville Copper. The communities that we spoke to were calling for them to do three things. Firstly, for them to listen to what communities are saying about these problems and acknowledge responsibility and engage in a formal reconciliation with communities according to Bougainvillean custom. Secondly, for them to contribute to helping to find solutions to the problems. So we've called for them as a starting point to recommit to funding the independent environmental assessment of the site, which was started, in fact, back in 2014, but couldn't go ahead because of their divestment. And thirdly, people just really want Rio Tinto to contribute financially towards helping fix the problems. These are huge problems which require substantial resourcing to fix them, both technical resourcing and financial resources. And the autonomous Bougainville government and people of Bougainville just simply do not have those resources. I mean, as one man kind of put it to me, he said, we can't control these problems with our bare hands. These are things that require engineers and expertise of that kind to get there on the ground and work out how they can be resolved. But we recognise in the report also that Rio Tinto is not the only party responsible. Obviously, the Papua New Guinea government also has responsibility for addressing the human rights abuses by its own people, and the Papua New Guinea government profited for a long time from the mine as well. And they have responsibilities and they have to try and help address the problems, particularly with interim urgent measures where people's kind of lives are immediately at risk, for example, from levee collapse or from flooding. And then we say also that the Australian government has responsibility here because Australia was actually the colonial power in charge of Papua New Guinea at the time that it was agreed that the mine go ahead. They were the ones who set up the agreements that imposed these very low environmental standards on the company at the time. And therefore, we believe that they have, at the very least, a strong moral responsibility to help contributing to fixing the problem.
Have Rio Tinto responded to your report in any way?
We met with Rio Tinto a couple of times in relation to the report. They chose not to give us a formal response to publish with the report, but they have said that they are discussing the recommendations that we've made at a senior level internally. So far, they haven't made any commitments to do anything about what we've said, but we're hopeful that we can continue to have dialogue with them about these issues.
Finally, Karen, I know that in Bougainville they had their referendum vote for independence, and you really got a sense that there was a hope in Bougainville that things would change and be different there. When you spoke to the people of Bougainville, were they hopeful that things would be resolved?
Well, I think that people have very mixed reactions. I mean, there is clearly a lot of hope for the possibility of a new future for the island, and that was very apparent when we were there. But with that comes real kind of anxieties and tensions around the future, for example, of mining more generally on the island and what part that will play in the island's future, and particular around the issue of whether Panguna should be reopened or not. We deliberately in our research avoided asking people about their opinions around whether the mine should be reopened or not, because I know that that's a really sensitive point out there at the moment, and There are mixed views in the community about that because for some people, they feel that the island just doesn't have the resourcing to establish its own independence any other way, whereas other people are vehemently opposed to mining continuing. But the one thing that unites everyone is the need for Rio Tinto to return and address its legacy there.
That was Karen Adams, the legal director at the Human Rights Law Centre here in Melbourne and co-author of After the Mine, Living with Rio Tinto's Deadly Legacy. And as a spokesperson for Rio Tinto told The Guardian newspaper that BCL was compliant with applicable regulatory requirements up until the mine's operations were suspended in 1989, the spokesperson said they acknowledged the concerns raised in the HRLC report, but could not comment because it had not been able to see the mine because of the conflict and challenging security situation.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, you are listening to Pacific Beat. My name is Talia Olatia, and there are some good news stories coming out of this global pandemic. And in Guam, it's a case of people power. Facing a shortage of face masks, a group of volunteers has now come together to make new ones, trying different techniques from 3D printing to hand-sewn masks. Nurses have been worried about the lack of personal protective equipment, or PPEs, for medical workers. Here's what Glynis Almonte, who heads up Guam's Nurses Association, told us last week.
Right now, I think our nurses and our frontliners are really doing their best. But the biggest problem now that's coming up or happening right now are the PPEs. Just like anywhere in the U.S. and other parts of the world, the PPEs are becoming to be a problem. We're hoping we could order, but there's no place to order because the orders for PPEs are prioritized for the hospital settings and the public.
That was Glynis Almonte, the head of the Guam Nurses Association there. But people like Cyrus Lura are coming to the rescue. The ABC's Natalie Whiting spoke with Cyrus.
We learned that there's a coming shortage of PPE or personal protective equipment for medical professionals on Guam. And so a number of us have access to 3D printers, sewing machines, and just experience crafting things. And so we kind of mobilized in the last few weeks, developed some prototypes based on standards that have been used in other hospitals around the country and around the world. And we've tested them out in our local hospitals, and the doctors and nurses seem very, actually really like them. And so we've started producing them. And just in the last, everything went from start to finish in about 3 weeks.
Wow. And so this has just been people in Guam wanting to do what they can to help.
Absolutely. I mean, Guam is unique because it's a small island. It's quite far away from a lot of traditional shipping lines. And so we don't have as quick of supply routes as other places do. And so we are competing with a lot of other hospitals in the U.S. at this moment just for the same limited supply of PPE. So we realized that there might be a need to resort to homemade PPE, which is not as good as medical quality, but it's still better than nothing. And so the CDC in the U.S. has stated that, homemade PPE are a method of last resort to protect medical professionals. And so that's what we're doing. We're trying to provide at least one additional line of protection before we run out completely.
How big is the concern on Guam about running out of PPE altogether?
I think it's a very big concern, but it's a concern that's shared around the country. This isn't a Guam-only problem around the country. In fact, just last week, the New England Journal of Medicine published an article about that a number of hospitals around the country are already stating that they're having a worrisome shortage of PPE. And because it takes a while for factories and such to sort of build up their capacity, and because supply chains do take a while to transfer these PPE around the country, being a small island very far out from the mainland in the Pacific, we don't really anticipate being able to compete as aggressively as, say, New York or California will be able to. So we're doing the best we can. We have phenomenal people working on this problem in Guam, but we're recognizing that there needs to be one additional line of protection or safety net, and so we're trying to provide that as best we can.
And how many volunteers have you got on board trying to help out with this project?
Well, we put out our first call for volunteers just a few days ago. We already have about 125, 150 people that want to get involved. There's not many 3D printers on Guam, but we already have a few dozen right now that are getting ramped up. But we have a lot of people that are into sewing, and they're really stepping up, even older folks, and it's really a way that it's been very inspiring seeing how many people are coming together to help.
And is it just the medical staff that you're looking to supply at this point, or are you trying to get them out more broadly as well?
We do want to get it out more broadly. Right now, we are primarily targeting medical professionals because they experience the highest viral loads and they experience the greatest danger when it comes to contracting COVID-19 and the consequences of contracting it. But after that, we're looking at first-line responders, teachers, folks that work in grocery stores, people that really come into contact with or have high risk of contracting COVID-19, but right now are not really being targeted by relief efforts.
And it's only started in recent weeks, obviously, but how many PPE have you managed to make so far, and do you have particular goals?
In the first couple of weeks, we're really focusing on prototypes and finding out what sort of PPE work best in Guam. Face shields has turned out to be really the thing that's greatest need and also the safest to make. Not all plans out there for PPE are safe to develop, and so we've been working very closely with medical pros and just standards that we see around the states to make sure that we're developing PPE that are safe. And so right now, face shields are what's really in demand, and also face masks. But 3D printed face masks are somewhat dangerous, and so we're focusing more on sewn cloth face masks and then 3D printed face shields. And so far, we've been able to develop probably about 100 or so face shields. That's really in the last 24 hours. We're hoping to put them out at about 50 plus per day moving forward. And then face masks, we've already developed about a couple hundred as well.
Wow. And aside from the obvious assistance this will be providing in terms of the PPE itself, is this sending a good message, I guess, of hope and resilience and community at what is a difficult time?
I hope so. This is a very difficult time, and so it is a way for people to get involved. We are encouraged by the local government to stay home as much as possible. And I think it can be very disempowering to be at home and feel that you don't really have an ability to get involved. And so we're trying to promote this widely so that it's really a way for people from their homes to be able to make a difference and directly be able to help protect the lives of the people who are really on the front lines, risking their own lives, doing all they can to protect us.
And one more question for you, Cyrus. How are you feeling as a resident of Guam? Obviously, there's been concerns about the health system and having enough beds and enough hospital staff with COVID-19. How are you feeling as a resident?
I think, like many people, there is an element of just nervousness and just unsettledness because this is a very unique and very different situation. In the past, Guam has experienced super typhoons and such, and so we're used to kind of shutting down and pulling together and helping each other. But with something like this, where you are discouraged from being able to interact with each other, rightfully so, it's a very different experience. And because it lasts so much longer than typhoon recovery, this is a very... It both feels familiar and also feels very different. And I think it's something that we're all kind of learning as we go along. And it's definitely been a very jarring experience.
A great story there about people power. That was Cyrus Lura talking there to ABC's Natalie Whiting.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, before we go, the latest on Cyclone Harold, which intensified into a Category 5 storm overnight with winds up to 215 kilometres an hour expected at its centre. It's currently tracking southeast through Vanuatu's central islands and is expected to pass slowly through the country's central islands, places like Santo, Malekula, Umbrim and Pentecost. There's forecast for damaging gale force winds, destructive storm force winds and hurricane force
force winds with heavy rainfalls and flash flooding over low-lying areas as well. Thousands of people across Vanuatu are bunkered down this morning because of Cyclone Harold. Manson Taridenga is a disaster officer for the province of Panama in Vanuatu's north. We spoke to him just moments ago.
I think we are still preparing for the worst. Since this morning, we had another warning, a 21 warning. So it comes like DC Harold is moving east. So it's on the line where we are. Currently, we are still waiting and we are prepared. All three islands, Ambamabo Pentecost, we are on alert. And people are well informed to start look for safe centers and safe areas. We have equipped elderlies and other vulnerable families. So we are now in preparation.
So keep listening to ABC Radio Australia across the day for more news and updates. Have a good day. I'll catch you tomorrow.